This is Yo Rocco.
My goal is to give people ingredients, you know, and then they brew their own faith.
Hey, this is Rocky Suppinger. You're listening to the Yo Rocco podcast, my weekly conversation with church leaders about their interesting projects. Thank you for listening. This week I talked to Trip Fuller. Trip is the founder and weekly broadcaster of the Homebrewed Christianity podcast that many of you will be familiar with. If you're not, look it up on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. It's a really indispensable thing for church leaders and anybody interested in the life of the church or theology to listen to. He's been doing that since 2008. And so I was initially interested to talk to Trip just to get some advice on how to do a podcast. And he was pretty generous in that regard, but also because he's working on a couple of really interesting projects right now. One is an upcoming conference here in Southern California, organized with John Cobb, a conference focused on ecology and theology and the life of the church in the coming changed environmental climate that humanity is going to be living in. He is working with Brian McLaren on that conference to put a track together for participants. And so that's a really cool thing to talk to him about. And he's also about to make a transition into working with something called The Hatchery, which is not exactly a seminary, not exactly a project for starting new churches, but a hybrid of both. And that's actually where most of our conversation landed. So Trip doesn't need a ton of introduction. He's just really fun to listen to. You come away from conversations with Trip feeling like you've learned something, but that you still have more you really want to learn. So thanks to Trip for his time this week. Thank you for listening. Here is my conversation with Trip Fuller.
I'm going to ask you for some podcasting advice later on. That was part of my hidden agenda to have you on was you're an experienced podcaster, and I wanted to pick your brain a little bit. But we talked last week about this conference that's happening here in Claremont in June, and you want to do a live podcast of Homebrewed Christianity at a church venue in town as part of that, where you know you have a couple kegs of beer and there's a sponsor and you do beer glasses. And I was really hopeful that we would be able to do that. You were gracious enough to invite us to host it. So I talked to my colleague here there at the church, the head of staff, and she took it to the property committee. And like a lot of churches, I think you've dealt with, there's like a no alcohol policy at the church, right? And so it's not going to go. I'm sad to say our property folks have recently kind of turned away wedding receptions and like a symphony thing where there was going to be wine, and we told them, well, we have this no alcohol policy, so you can't do it. They do want to reconsider that policy, but not in the short time frame. So I'm apologizing that it's not going to work at our church.
Don't worry, I will survive, and I don't think it was you and your devious ways.
Well, I'm disappointed though. I went to the live podcast you did at the Progressive Youth Ministry Conference in Chicago, and those things are fun, and I was really hopeful that we would be able to have one in our congregation. So we're not. But I want to ask you about the live podcast thing that you do, and what's like your biggest hope for what those actually accomplish?
Well, I mean, I feel like the biggest hope is always just, one, getting enough audio over 2.5 hours that you get an hour of something you can put on the internet. So, knowing that there's, you know, 20,000 more people that end up listening to an edited version of it, I kind of plan live events. At least I do now. Originally, they were like horribly boring. It was people in a brewery watching me interview people for 3 hours. I loved it, but you know, like by the end, there's 1, 2, 3 people left, and I'm just like, I don't care. It's a podcast. I'm recording it for later. Congratulations for staying. But so later I realized adding multiple elements, turning it into a event and spectacle of sorts, with an awareness that you really only need an hour of it to be shareable on the internet. The goal was to kind of turn the live events into things that if you were there, you're the only one that really experienced what happened. Yeah. And the version online is like a little memento of something you didn't think was possible. So, sometimes I end up going over the edge, but the whole goal is usually for the live event to have this like super nerdy element, but to also have this like energy of walking on the edge of what you can get away with in the context, to make fun and light of things you don't know if you're normally allowed to when it comes to kind of faith and that kind of thing, to say and make jokes that almost everyone there would make with their friends about the topics but will never say in public or be caught laughing at, things like that. So like the live podcast for me is like get the content you need for an episode but also put on a show where everyone that's there has this moment where they go, okay, yeah, that's an event where I can be a little more, oh, I can see more of myself in what happened than you expected to be the case, I guess.
Yeah, and the one in Chicago that I participated in, that was totally the atmosphere. It was a lot of fun. The beer helps with that.
Yeah, well, the one in Chicago, I mean, there are a couple parts of it there. The group sing-along, I had no idea it was going to go as well as it did. When we sang Bohemian Rhapsody. And then I've also made a new rule not to make promises to sponsors to drink every time they set a pint glass in front of me. Because by the end, I had drank way, way, way more than I normally drink in a night by myself, let alone with microphones.
It's an occupational hazard of a live podcast where the sponsor has their name on a beer glass.
Yeah, well, that was a thing I'm going to try to avoid that part again. But you tell me, you're there. So it's your first time seeing the podcast live, but you've heard it and we've hung out before and stuff. Like, you tell me what you were expecting and what happened and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, what I was expecting was a lot more boring than what actually happened. I think what I was expecting was like what you described they used to be. It's that, you know, you sit up front and it's Tripp talking to somebody for 3 hours and the rest of us are sitting watching. But you guys made it really interactive because Tony Jones was also up there with you talking to people as they came on the podcast. You guys had this great, like, he was the straight man act going. And you were, you were getting a little bit more loose. And I mean, it was entertaining. I don't know if I didn't know you, and if I didn't like know the people that I was sitting with, having a good time with, I don't know if it would have been as fun. There's like a communal aspect to what you were doing that I think is great. Like, it's great. There's not many opportunities for people who are in ministry to get together in an environment like that and have really candid, frank, fun conversations about theology and the work that we're doing, and just enjoy being, you know, where they're at with the people that are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And in that room was like 200 progressive youth ministers. So progressive youth ministers are such a niche market. Like, you are, to succeed, you have to remain at least have one corner of your soul that's a 14-year-old boy. Right? Doesn't matter who you are, in order to join a teenager in life, you have to have that sense of humor somewhere, and you, when it comes out, you don't just shame it and make fun of it. So I love the PYM podcast because my thought is always like, I will make jokes that all these youth ministers wish they got to say back to their students, but they don't because they're trying to be mature, but they always laugh on the inside.
Yeah, right. Well, The other piece about that I wanted to ask you is that, you know, you talked about learning to do things differently with these podcasts, and they used to be one way, and you've learned to do them differently. Like, the thing I always appreciate about the stuff that you're involved in, from this event to your live podcast to way back to the theology after Google thing that happened here in Claremont back in like 2010 or 2011, I remember you were involved in that. Mm-hmm. It always has this air of like, we're just going to try this, and we're going to see what happens, and even if it just falls on its face, it's still going to be fun. It'll make for a good story later. You know, the Bohemian Rhapsody sing-along, like, that's a terrible idea in some ways, but it was a lot of fun. I've never participated in something like that.
Yeah, but think of this. A Bohemian Rhapsody sing-along in Fourth Presbyterian Church in Chicago with Amy Butler, senior minister at Riverside in New York. Yeah. Like, the chance that happens is so small. Like, that's the kind of weird detail when you're reading an autobiography of, like, some person from church history where you're like, oh, Gerhard Aibling studied with Bonhoeffer at the Underground Seminary for a week but found him way too obsessed with Scripture and obnoxious, and he left. But there's this one picture of them together reading Bart, and you're like, that was awesome. I wish I was there. Like, that's the kind of thing when you're at Fourth Pres doing Queen sing-along and Amy Butler joins.
Yeah, and everybody in the room knew all the words.
Yeah, I feel like if you were in youth group during the time of Wayne's World, which most youth ministers that are around today were.
That's how everybody knows it.
Yeah.
Not from the original.
But like at my in Southern California, the church I worked at for 7 years with students, that was one of the songs everyone knew we could play on youth trips. They sing along. Here, though, it also includes like Green Day and No Doubt and that like all the kind of Southern California music. And I could play in the youth van the entire Exodus album by Bob Marley and everyone sings along. It's amazing.
Wow. You've been at this podcasting thing for a long time. How old is the Homebrewed Christianity podcast?
The first episode that like made its way into a podcast stream was March of 2008.
Okay. And what was the idea when you first started? Was it just, hey, there's this cool technology and this is a way for me to kind of talk about stuff I'm interested in? Or did you have a definite goal you were going for?
Well, I had a kind of like beer discussion group thing at the church I was working at, First Christian in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I realized early on that if we like picked a book and then get together the next month, half of the 2 hours we're hanging out is me explaining what was in the book, because only one or two of them probably read it. Some of them may have looked at it, or maybe Googled to see what someone else said on a blog about it. But I was playing the deliverer of content most of the time rather than discussing the ideas. And I wanted to have more conversation if you're at a pub rather than me talking. Plus, if I'm in a pub and talking for the first half, I'm not drinking anything. And that kind of defeats the purpose of managing to have pub discussion groups called work if you're a minister. So, I thought, I'll just interview the person that we're going to read and send everyone in the group the MP3. That way they can listen to it, maybe help them read the book, or they pick parts to read after they hear it, or at least they have an hour of me talking to them that is kind of the content part. So when we get there, we can just jump into talking. And that's how it happened. So I did like people I knew first.
I was going to say, it's pretty gutsy just to call up an author and say, hey, can I interview you?
Well, I mean, I was kind of a leader in our local emergent cohort at that time. I was in doing my master's. I helped with all the public theology stuff at school. So, like, you know, we're putting on an event, and John Dominique Crossan's coming. So I'm like, oh, yeah, so here you're going to speak here, blah, 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 and I interview you in between things. And So that, like, after you had that, Brian, you know, a couple semi-legit people where then I can put them on the email to people that I'd never have met but read their books and would love to talk to, then they all kind of just started saying yes. The crazy thing is that, you know, I had done, I don't know, 7 or 8 of them, and then sent the MP3s to other friends who wanted to use them for their group. Another friend of mine said, you do know there's a thing called a podcast that sets up RSS feeds that delivers MP3s. And I was like, no. He's like, yeah. So then, back then, that's how the podcast was born. So by the time the episodes I'd already done, like, or not episodes, but interviews, were released on it, we had like real traction, which I then leveraged towards getting interviews with people I didn't know, but always wanted to interview.
That's really cool. It started with you just sharing the MP3 files with your friends, and that built up a base, like an audience, so that when you did make it a podcast and put it online, you already had a critical mass of people who were interested in it.
Yeah, because, I mean, essentially, there were like 7 or 8 friends who had pub groups, and they're like, hey, if we put them up here like this, then we can just send the link to everyone in our pub group, they listen, and we don't have to talk.
When was the last time you went back and listened to one of those first several episodes?
Well, occasionally I listen. Now, what is the first episode that's available now is not the first episode.
You don't even have the file of the very first one you did?
Oh, yeah. Some things are accessible to everyone and some things are not. And
what was the first one you ever did?
When we decided to start the podcast, as opposed to just sharing the MP3s, then we had to add like intros and blah blah blah. But the first episode was me and my buddy Chad, who was the kind of the co-host before Bo, discussing the podcast. It was the most useless conversation. Like if you listen back to it, and then I remember we posted it. And it's like 25 minutes of us discussing that we're going to do a podcast and what the name Metaphor meant. And then we listened, we downloaded ourselves off iTunes and listened to it. And I just remember sitting in my tent thing outside. Has mosquito net around the side because it was North Carolina, lots of mosquitoes. And I was smoking a cigar and listened to myself off iTunes. And I felt like so accomplished. Now if you listen to it, it just sounds like the worst description of a project that 24-year-olds come up with when they're in seminary.
Yeah.
They're like, we're going to start this podcast called Homebrewed Christianity, and we want to be ecclesiological innovators. Yeah, Chad, what do you think that means? We know, like, people that are creative and invent, and it was us just, it was horrible, really horrible.
You're a heady dude, and you talk with great ease, you know, using really sophisticated theological vocabulary. And it seems like as you've gotten more experienced at this, you've figured out how to translate that into something that you know anybody can understand. But maybe you were just learning that earlier on.
Well, I mean, I think definitely. Like, I mean, at this point, I've probably done 400 or 500 interviews, I guess. So. Like, when you've done that many interviews, you get better at it, even if you don't get good at it. I think over time you get better at it. You also have, like, kind of your fallback questions when nothing's working. Like, hopefully they'll say something about this.
Right.
I've also done it enough just to be okay not using something. Like, where you're like, well, that was useless. That person could not do this. And it is amazing. Like, if you could write 500 pages on a topic, but could not have 30 minutes of coherent conversation with someone about it who read the book. I interview like theologians. I feel like if I read it, I should be able to ask questions enough. You have something to say. Some people just are not built for conversation. And so I just think whenever I get frustrated, Trip, listen to that first podcast. You were not built for this. You eventually got better at it.
The purpose of it has shifted, obviously, from being something that is a supplement to a pub discussion group. What is it that you're, like, what's your one or two sentence description of what you're trying to accomplish with Homebrewed Christianity now?
I mean, vocationally, I feel like my calling is to kind of get all the richness out of the Christian tradition, the academy, and that kind of stuff into the hands of lay people. That the church would end up being more beautifully embodied if its theology didn't suck. So instead of having, you know, like, oh, everyone think this new thing Trip has, my goal is to give people ingredients, you know, and then they brew their own faith metaphorically. And so, like, my goal in the interviews is always to kind of get the best stuff out of this person's text that we're talking about so that if Rocky doesn't have time to go read, write this 500-page autobiography of Bonhoeffer that Charles Marsh wrote, I kind of brought up all the different questions and connections I saw in it from the text to kind of our contemporary church situation. You can listen to it, get into it, enjoy it. Maybe buy the book, read the chapters about the stuff you like. My goal is just to kind of like hopefully raise the theological median in the church. You have a few more thinking Christians.
Yeah, and so you must just read like a maniac.
I mean, I do. I read a lot, and I enjoy it. So, but I started reading theology like in middle school. So I'm not normal. I was like the person most youth ministers hated to have ask questions.
Because you were smarter than most of them, and you knew more theology.
Well, and like you, let's say you were even nerdy and stuff. You're tempted to answer a question a teenager asked that you're really thinking as well. And at that point, the other 40 teens in the room are like looking at you like, what are you two talking about? Right? Like,
yeah.
You're in confirmation class, and I'm working hard just to get them to learn basic kind of Christian concepts, engaging a story of Jesus. And then someone goes, well, Tripp, you know, like you mentioned the other day, something about that guy... like the book that Marcus Borg and N.T. Wright wrote together on historical Jesus. Well, I got it, and I was reading it, and I just think that this whole section in Matthew makes more sense when you see that Caesar titles are being appropriated by Jesus, you know? And like, and I'm sitting there like, yes, please. And what are the rest of teenagers going, what the hell is this? Like, why are they doing this? So, you know, like...
Just going to be on the test?
Yeah. What are we supposed to do with that? So you know, even a youth minister that's interested in it can get led down a road of being ignored by everyone else.
You know, that little illustration reminds me of one of the first youth groups I led here in Claremont with the church that I work at, and it was like, you know, it's a Sunday night and kids have got homework and they're just, you can just tell, you can feel it when they're not like engaged. And I can't even remember what the biblical story was that we were using. It was something out of the Gospels. And I brought up the idea of a parallel, like a gospel parallel comparison, right? Like just basic stuff, comparing different versions of the same story in different Gospels. And all of a sudden, they all got really interested and they sat up and they started asking a bunch of questions. And I realized, oh, this is what I've been doing wrong. Like, I have a bunch of sort of nerds in my youth group, and I need to interact with them on that level and not just sort of, like, try to ask these spiritualized questions based on the Bible stories.
Yeah, but how that's an example of why I like doing the podcast, that there really are a lot of people with wonderful brains, critical thinking skills, experiences, and intuitions that want to get processed theologically, and the church is still just being all sentimental and not trusting them with all the data and stuff and tools and metaphors that scholars use. And I just think that we're kind of stabbing ourselves in the foot, because those questions are there, and it's not like you weren't even able to help the students think through it and process it and help it inspire them to engage the parables in their own faith. It's just we're kind of taught or intuit or I don't know what it is, just that people don't want to go there. And I think that the depth of the faith and the thinking through critically and all that kind of stuff is an asset for faith rather than a barrier to it.
So put that insight or that conviction in conversation with the Pew data that came out this week that surprised absolutely no one about the people who affiliate with no religious tradition. Now there's more of them than affiliate with Christianity, and the continued decline of Christianity and so on and so forth, and yet you remain convinced that a thoughtful, intelligent engagement with the content of faith is important, while there's a lot of other people in the church running around with, like, you know, the sky is falling, which maybe it is, but looking at, what do we have to do differently? What do we have to change? What has to, you know, be completely transformed so that the church, you know, is relevant in today's context? But what I hear you saying is, well, this intelligent conversation and thoughtfulness that we've always had needs to needs to still be what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a couple things that came into my mind reading it is, culture is totally cool now if you just say you aren't affiliated. I know that if you were to take the survey what is it that's important and meaningful to you, in most of the congregations I've served, the younger you get on the, if you're serving the people that attend, the more important their faith is to their identity if they're the ones that actually show up. And part of it, I think, is just because for a lot of the older members of the congregation, they grew up at a time where being a member of the church was kind of necessary for culture, social, business reasons, and it was just kind of assumed. So I think a lot of the people that are leaving the church or disaffiliating it's less an issue with the church and more just the wonderful good news that the church doesn't have to serve functions other than its mission. So I think it's pretty cool if the church becomes full of people and communities where they choose their Christian identity and are attempting to embody it and things. I mean, just you've been in trustee meetings and elder meetings, and you look around the room and think to yourself, how many of the people here are making this decision because they wake up in the morning and are attempting to follow Christ? Like, that's not what's framing most of it. It's more around institutional preservation of some kind of social anchor for them or something like that. So I'm the Pew thing wasn't really super surprising.
And
I actually think we might be, I think as people no longer have to come, then those that choose to come and be a part of a community are the ones who are going to be more likely to actually do what Jesus wanted his disciples to do, rather than, you know, debate what words we use in a hymn book.
Right. So in the next couple of weeks, as all the newspapers run stories about this research and over the next several months as blog posts and magazine articles and even books are spawned by this data, I want to see who you're talking to about it to make the case you just made. Like, who would you have on your podcast who you think is putting way too much stock in this trajectory and in this data that you would want to say, hold on a minute?
Well, I really want to interview Richard Florey from, I think he teaches at USC, but he has this long grant right now studying shifts in religious identity. Religious entrepreneurship is one of the metaphors, like what are the spaces in the religious marketplace that people are creatively engaging in. Things like that. He wrote a blog post kind of about it, specifically related to evangelicals, but the data and stuff is rather fascinating to me.
I said he's working all that into a book.
Yeah, the study's not done. It's like a long-term study that he's doing, I think, with the Templeton Foundation. He works at the Center for Religion and Civic Culture in LA. But I think one of the things that I find fascinating about what he highlights is that to identify like if you think of like we have like cultural climate change around the church and that kind of stuff going on, and it just means that if you are nominally invested in all sorts of things, namely groups, that disassociation with groups and institutions is on the rise, and that is a cultural shift in climate that is not technically religious. Like, you could write the very same studies about any institution going on, right? Okay. Like, if you were like, where do you buy your hamburgers? And every way the survey was written from the 20th century would have included, like Hardee's / Carl's Jr., McDonald's, Burger King, blah, 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 blah. And then like, oh, in California, In-N-Out is this up-and-coming denomination. It's growing and taking over the marketplace. And like, any industry, in a sense, is being affected by these same cultural shifts in climate.
And that's been happening for a long time. I mean, back in 98, 99, I worked for the YMCA on this national project that was supposed to get young adults connected to civic life, and all anybody talked about was Bowling Alone, the book by Robert Putnam.
Yeah.
The decline in civic participation since right after World War II. There was this huge boom of civic involvement of all kinds, including church involvement, which, you know, right after World War II is when a lot of the mainline Protestant denominations were planting churches all over the country. I mean, the church I serve was planted in the aftermath of World War II. And ever since then, it's been like a 40-year-plus slow decline.
Mm-hmm.
Churches, Rotary, you know, civic groups, the main title of that book is from bowling leagues enduring the same kind of decline. And, I mean, sometimes I make that qualification, and then I think, are we kind of letting ourselves off the hook a little bit, like to say, well, yeah, the church is declining and things, you know, don't look the way they used to, but, you know, that's happening to everybody. Is it enough to acknowledge that, or does there need to be more urgency to say, well, but we can take that seriously enough to figure out how to actually have a meaningful impact in the new era that we live in now, where disassociation is the norm? How do you do ministry in a setting where people are more and more inclined not to associate with a group of any kind?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it, even if you just took like the hamburger metaphor, right? Like, we're not McDonald's, the church. The church is not McDonald's, where you're trying to figure out, they're now testing breakfast kale salads.
I heard at McDonald's. About that. Yeah.
Right? Like, we're not, like, I feel like when people are responding to this, they're mostly responding from whatever their brand loyalty is in their tribe, and where they're trying to advocate basically something like, well, look, some respond in ways that are real defensive and protective over what they have. They could say something like, look, McDonald's is significantly cheaper than so many other options. Poverty's not going away, so we don't need to really worry. Just know that our market share is going to shrink for a while. But people are going to come back around because the golden arches are the golden arches. Let's just stick to our guns, keep it low, and, you know, not hope people don't ask about the health questions. Then others are like, whoa, 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 we're McDonald's. Part of being the golden arches is being badass and winning all the time. We're going to get this new marketplace. Maybe people currently think of maybe-ish meat products that are sprayed with a liquid that makes it smell like it was grilled when they see us now. But we're going to change things. Breakfast kale salads. Come on, people. Let's have our breakfast kale salads, and we'll test them on the frontiers of culture in L.A. You know, and that's kind of the response. But I think, like, as a church, I think we have to go back and say something like, is our goal being McDonald's? Or our brand, or is our goal like to be the church? And maybe there's as many shifts in how the church could be practiced today as there is in eating. Like McDonald's succeeded because of the rise of overworked and underpaid people in the United States, the desire to end your lunch hour faster to get back to work, the rampant cultural focus on success to the neglect of one's physical well-being, the rise of double, you know, all both parents being employed and not having time to prepare meals and have time together. Like, it succeeded because of a bunch of things that are unrelated to the food that's there. Right. Maybe the church needs to go back to its understanding of itself, its mission, the community, the sacraments, and these kinds of things, and then figure out, like, how do we do what it is we do when the drive-through for every American isn't the way we eat anymore? Now you have, like, pop-up restaurants that exist for a week and completely change neighborhoods' expectations around what food is, what community is, and how you eat. Like a couple weeks ago, there was one down in Hermosa. It was a pop-up thing, and it was crazy because it had like these four giant long tables. And for just a couple weeks, they had these really sweet meals. Each table started at a set time, and it was family-style eating at these long picnic benches, and you kind of bought your seat, sat down, and ate whatever you wanted. Now, in it, tons of people, because the food was awesome and the set price, like tons of people met their neighbors and people that are on the beach with them all the time they had never talked to before because the whole way of this pop-up restaurant was sitting them down together. Now, I read a story where someone was talking about like they have all these other people that they see the face and know their names and started interacting with each other because of this pop-up restaurant. Pop-up restaurant succeeded. But it doesn't mean that like its success is on a scale completely different than the McDonald's down the corner.
Right. Were you at the restaurant? Did you go?
No. One of my friends that writes for the LAist brought it up, and then I said, note to self, this is story I'll use at some point. Yeah. And now here it was, like it was sitting right there. I got to tell it to you, Rocky.
Well, thank you. It would be really fascinating to find one of the people who organize it and talk to them, because there's two things that strike me about that. One, the whole point was for it to exist for a short time and then be gone, and it has served its purpose. Two, the effect of building community and getting people to connect with their neighbors was clearly accomplished based on what people said, but I would bet that's not what they were first and foremost trying to do. They were probably first and foremost trying to make really, really great food, right? Like the food is at the centerpiece of what they're doing, and a byproduct of that, maybe there's some intent, because when you have family style eating and these long benches, it encourages that kind of interaction, and you have to pay attention to the space. But I have this theory about like trying to quote unquote build community is sort of self-defeating. That community gets built when people get together around something that they're all really passionate about.
Yeah, and sometimes I feel like churches, because the collection of people there is a bit arbitrary, because of its like inertia at a given congregation, they spend a lot of energy trying to figure out how to build community when human beings kind of want to.
Right, right.
And maybe that's something. Can I ask you a question of an idea I had that I have no idea if it's awesome or horrible?
Absolutely. But let me make one observation real quick before we do that, because the chief complaint of a lot of people in congregations is a lack of relational depth. Like they say, we don't know each other here well enough.
And whose problem's that?
I mean, what you just said is that people just do that. People make those connections. But I have serious doubts about our skills in this day and age for making those kind of connections and building relationships, because we've left the era when the culture as a thing supported, institutionally supported, the building of those kinds of bonds and relationships. Now, I mean, like, I'm not like romanticizing those, because they, when they were really strong, they tended to be exclusionary, and you know, it was you had to have a certain level of privilege to get into those. But I just don't know if people in this day and age do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I mean I was mostly thinking of the fact like when churches are obsessed with, they're like, well, you know, we really need to figure out how to have community and stuff. I always wonder, like, what is it you think you're doing when you're here? Like, what else are we supposed to be doing?
Right. Is there like a model or like a mythic community experience out there that people feel like is not happening at the church?
I think that, you know, psychologically, like the type of intimacy and stuff people can have gets set so young that when we're wanting to develop healthy patterns of community, that's kind of why I think student ministry is so important, because we kind of learn what is it like to be in community and intimate and open and honest with people. And that I think kind of gets set, and then you might make little changes along your life, but without a lot of work, the type of relationships you have and the boundaries you put up with most people are set. And and who it is you're okay being open and honest with at certain types of levels is kind of a something that's in there about you. The cool part to me in Christian community, different than the different groups of friends I have, is that we can get together, and the liturgy itself creates opportunities of being open and honest communally in ways you never would with the person next to you. Like, even your own partner, right? Like, I pray a prayer of confession, confessing my sins next to my wife, who I have yet to apologize for doing the same damn thing to her the night before, right? Like, and then I'm saying it next to this rich Republican dude who I'm pretty sure I can't stand in many ways. And we have our arguments going on, and I'm just disgusted by him. And he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And then and then I know that Elgin's sitting right there, and he's watching his dad admit that he's not the greatest thing of all time, which is not something I'm wonderfully gifted at doing. Like, that whole thing opens up space where if we take it seriously together, we're kind of practicing being open about the reality of our lives and our relationships, doing it in a context where grace abides, and that means you have to learn to live with yourself because you're lovable and you may not think it, and that's how God sees these other people that you're rolling your eyes at and flicking off with your hand in your pocket. As we see all those people being handed the same bread and the same cup, then I think we're seeing we're leaning into kind of what community looks like. When churches get obsessed with community in ways where somehow we aren't working on being intentional and attentive to those patterns that exist in the worship itself, I feel like we're kind of really missing out. Because those things are pretty crazy. Like, when will you have seen a politician say they made a mistake? Either you sit next to them in church, or they got caught with a hooker in a bathroom. That's the only times. And, like, what would, like, think of all these different, like, places you exist in your life where how often do you get to be honest? And there we practice it.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool.
You're kind of I haven't read her book yet, but it sounds a lot like what I've heard Rachel Held Evans' most recent book is all about, is liturgy as this space for transformation to happen, where particularly younger people are more receptive to it than previous generations have been.
Well, I haven't read the book yet, so if she agrees with me, you're welcome, Rachel.
All right. Well, you should read
it. I'm sure she borrowed it from listening to the podcast.
Yeah, you should have run a podcast. Okay, you were gonna run an idea by me. I don't want to lose that.
Oh, the other example of the pop-up thing that I thought was cool. I like when I got to LA, my teenagers told me that I needed to get real denim, and by that they meant like I shouldn't get my jeans at Costco. I found this LA jean maker, it's a DSTLD is the names, and they make, like, you know, cool hip jeans or whatnot, and you know, they have like all super eco justice filled cloth, and then they make them by well paid seamstress types in LA, so you know, you can feel good with your $100 jeans on,
right. That have hold you buy them.
Yeah, they're the jeans that are so fancy it comes with a card that says don't wash for at least 6 months. Just freeze them for 2 days if they start to smell and rub the dirt off. So they have a rather intense online community around the jeans. Like mailing list of stuff, like they talk about the different places when they're getting fabric in, and you can kind of order your jeans when you hear about where the fabric comes from, the size, and all this kind of stuff. So, I've gotten a couple pairs of jeans from them, really like it. I always read the emails and stuff. Then they had a pop-up store and in West Hollywood in this little room. I mean, it wasn't very big at all, where, like, one tenant was moving in and one was moving out. And so, like, for a couple days, you could kind of go in and see all, you know, actually, like, look at the jeans and try them on or whatever. And it was really crazy because you showed up and you knew that, like, everyone that was in there were basically people in L.A. who wanted to get jeans that didn't kill the planet, oppress the poor, and look nice, and did it through this online service so you could pay the workers well by not having storefront and stuff. And it just so happened that for a couple days they could hang them up on a bar and you kind of walk in. And, and then to me, gone. That was, yeah, and then it was gone. And but it was cool. And you're still connected to this community. I get the emails every other week. There's some really sweet, really dark Japanese denim that just came in. And if I was employed, I would probably have bought a pair because it looked awesome.
Can we talk about that piece for a second?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So you're not working in a church right now. What? I mean.
Well, I just finished. At the end of April was my last day. Church here in LA, and then in September I just took a job as the director of theology and the humanities at a new educational institution, the Hatchery LA, which is
Spencer Burke's project.
Yeah, and the Disciples of Christ region, and they're partnering with United Theological Seminaries in Minneapolis as like an extension campus for this new form of theological education. And like the whole thing is basically to it's basically like if you want to get a theology and business degree over 3 years, live in community and start something that's not a church, then that's where you should go to do it. It's a common cause communities, the hip phrase. But basically, it's like Jesus wants you to do something. It could be nonprofit, advocacy, small business, whatever it is. It's just not working at a church. And over the 3 years, you get your theology degree, you get your business degree, and you develop a business plan, get a mentor, and launch a community space that's something other than where you serve Eucharist.
Wow. So how much did you know about this before you took this job? Because I know that the Hatchery was the sponsor of your live podcast in Chicago because their logo is the one on my glass that I got there.
Yeah, well, that was kind of the first time we significantly interacted about it, and then I heard about it, then we talked more about it, and I got offered the job in an email while, like, the day before I was preaching for a call at another church.
Oh, wow.
And then I was like, well, I guess we should pray about this. And the idea of getting to be a part of this new form of education and community building and stuff was just too enticing for me I just really couldn't pass it up.
So the title of the job is Director of Theology, is that what you said?
Yeah, Director of Theology and the Humanities.
Theology and the Humanities. So this is not a youth ministry thing, and this is what youth ministry is, what you've done for quite a while.
I still do lock-ins, though. I love that. Like, I really enjoy ministry.
You love lock-ins?
Yeah, dude.
I don't think I've ever heard that uttered by an adult in my life. I certainly said it. That they love lock-ins? Oh, man. I mean, I can appreciate the value of what they accomplish in terms of bonding and the experience the kids have, but man, I shudder at the thought of another lock-in.
So here's my 90-second guide to perfect lock-ins.
Let's hear it.
You start, you give a very strict start time at 7:00, and that way no one's eating when they get there. They leave all their food and snacks somewhere when they walk in. They go into an area, and you have someone running all those stupid get-to-know-you games where they practice names and crap.
Right.
And then at 7:40 or whatever, once you know everyone's really there so they're not getting interrupted again, you give the rules. I have 3 rules, and I make them entertaining, but I hold them accountable, and all the parents have initialed that if they break a rule, they're getting called and picked up. And it's like, don't get pregnant or do anything where you think about getting pregnant. Don't get hurt. And that means, like, if you kick someone, they kick you back, you're responsible for having irritated them where they kick you. Like, just don't get hurt. And then don't get arrested or do anything that if you got caught, you get arrested. They all start giggling because the rules are rather over the top. And then
I'm giggling.
Yeah, so every time I tell some story of something for each rule that's happened at a youth event where I'm like, yeah, and don't do that. Like one time I was like, yeah, and don't get arrested. Now, I don't know technically if it's illegal, but if for some reason at 3 in the morning you think that handicap movable toilet in the back closet is a place that you should use the restroom, just say no. Because, and that had happened previously. Anyway, it's like you give them the rules, they're all going, and then you go, all right, and the last thing is, most offensive thing you could do is whine or not participate. So if I think you're not participating or you're whining or deciding whether or not you want to do any of this, then you're just going to go home. Do we have some agreement here? And then they'll say yes. And then you do not let them sit down till 12:30.
Oh, man.
I'll have all the games planned, which are running, intense, hiding, moving, and it goes nonstop till 12:30. And at 12:30, you make a ginormous greasy breakfast, like sausage and eggs and crap like that. They eat it, and then you turn on a movie. Within 30 minutes, 90% are out. And then you look at the four or five that are left and go, do you want to play some role-playing games in the kitchen?
That's genius. I think my problem is that I just never watched you do a lock-in. You're gonna have to figure out a way to incorporate a lock-in into this new gig at the Hatchery.
Just do one for anyone, an adult lock-in. But we go to bed at 11.
Right, right. But so, are you gonna be teaching? Like, what is this role actually gonna look like in practice?
Yeah. So, 60% of the classes are taught by faculty at TwinSot, which is the Twin City School of Theology. And then 40% are taught by faculty here, so I'll teach some of them. Like in the spring, I'm teaching a class called Schools of Thought. It's like a hip title they have for like theology class. And also, I'm in charge of the kind of monthly gatherings around a text, around special guests and stuff. So if you like the podcast, those people will basically be coming to hang out at the Hatchery throughout the year, and the students have dinner with them, and then they do a little talk and Q&A with the students. And so I'm kind of like the curator of all the special guests and events and people that visit.
Oh, that sounds really great.
The whole idea is, I mean, it's real similar to it's like taking what the cool parts about Divinity School, the cool parts about communal living, and then mixing it up where you're leaving to actually start something new in the world versus serve an existing congregation.
Yeah, it's the perfect role for you, and I imagine that a few years in with three or four classes of graduates who are out doing these projects, the wealth of learning that you guys are going to have to share about what makes these a new type of church community work is going to be astounding.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm kind of excited about it, that assuming, the first 2 years succeed, so it sets a good inertia for growth, then I think the overall perks of getting to be involved will just be exciting. Plus, like, you'll be getting to, like, read religious texts and counter scriptures, theologians and stuff with people who are creative entrepreneurial types ready to take risks, not ones that just want a job at the church they grew up in. So right. I think like I'm going to end up learning all sorts of stuff from the students I would never learn in a normal classroom. So anyone that's listening to this that's interested, let me know, because first group starts in September, and each year there are 9 new students. And the first year you live on campus, when this is 3 blocks from the sand in Redondo Beach.
Wow. Yeah, okay, I'll put a link to the Hatchery on the page where I put the podcast at yorocco.com. It struck me when I talked to Spencer about it in Chicago that it's a very high commitment program. It's not a distance learning kind of thing. I mean, you got to go live there for just the first year or all 3 years.
Well, you live in the area all 3 years. The first year you live in, like, on the campus. I mean, there's student housing on the campus. And that's because you're learning the rhythm of the school. Right. And you're learning the people, because our goal as, and they're kind of like three different parts of the degree. I'm like the one in charge of learning. Then there's one in charge of living, and that's someone who's there to help them all develop their own spiritual practices, to facilitate communal rhythms of spiritual practice, kind of like a live-in spiritual director. And then there's a launch person who's the one that's like their entrepreneurial coach, who's helping them figure out like how it is you take this dream and then this idea, how do you take that, work it out with business leaders that need help, community leaders that need help, other faith communities, local government issues, and connect all the dots. And between the three of us and then all the kind of adjunct or additional faculty for the classes, the goal is that the tightness of the community means everyone supporting each other as they, you know, hatch.
Yeah.
Metaphor. These new things. It will be excellent.
It's the language about common cause communities is really intriguing to me. In the Presbyterian Church, we're really on a kick right now of talking about new worshiping communities. It seems to me like there's a pretty significant distinction between those two things.
Yeah, but I don't think they're like in conflict. It's just part of it is just recognizing that the church, like, there are people called to ministry, and their ministry is something other than a worshiping community. But that doesn't mean they won't be a part of them or won't be serving along with them. It's just
or that the thing that they're doing won't have worship as a part of it somehow.
Yeah, I mean, like, like, it could be all sorts of stuff. And one of the cool things we'll do during the first year is, like, as, like, we're going to have ways where people can kind of see the different projects people are working on, because I think that when people see what it is you do there, then they'll go, oh, okay, yeah, that would actually be the degree I didn't know existed that could support my dream becoming a reality. And they have this passion and calling from God, and they go like, well, where in the world does this happen? And perhaps the coolest part about it is just how many different leaders and different organizations locally, national religious groups are excited about the hatchery. That means we'll be able to help find partners for the students to take risks that they couldn't take on their own.
Well, I know some Presbyterians, just so you know.
If you're looking I mean, if there's a Presbyterian student and they're looking for certain types of support and stuff, then I will just literally call all my friends that I know are Presbyterians and tell them about it and say, hey, this person's doing this. Why would you not want to be a part of it? Like,
and I'm just a quick drive, man. I'm just a quick drive from Redondo Beach.
Yeah. And, yeah, so, you know, anyone that's interested, feel free to just contact me.
Yeah, I'll link all the information about the hatchery on the post as well, so people can follow up.
It's also like significantly cheaper than other divinity schools. I mean, that's when I found out that students paid way less. They paid less than I paid after scholarships. I was a bit I mean, I guess it's better for talking people into coming and taking a risk. But I was thinking like, wow. So the Disciples of Christ have actually put tons of money into this project. Yeah. And the students are going to benefit from it.
Interesting. Well, that I just lost my train of thought. We were talking earlier about editing out the bad habits that you know you have. That's one of them for me. Is I say interesting as a response a lot, and I recognize I did it, and then I forgot what I was going to ask you. Okay, so you still.
I want to tell you my idea though.
Okay, but you still have to move to Redondo Beach. If you're in Texas and you want to do this, you got to come here. You can't do it from Texas.
But you don't have to find a place to live or anything.
Right.
But already have the beds. I have seen them.
Right. But you think this is something that people with like kids and a family will be able to do?
In our first class, I know at least one of the students is married. with one kid who's still, you know, one itty-bitty, a daughter that's like six or so. And the thing is, like, because it's nine students each year that come in, we're super flexible. So, I mean, it's hard to describe, but think of like modular homes that can get rearranged in whatever way we need to fit the students that way. So it's rearranged in a way that the couple and their kid have their own living space and stuff, but it's still in the community. And then like two 24-year-old women, incoming students, have a similar thing, but they're more like roommates with a living room and kitchen and stuff in between.
And you gotta show up. You gotta show up knowing what your common cause community would look like, what you want to do, or is that something that you expect will emerge over the time that students are there?
You basically come in with an initial. You come in with the egg of an idea.
Ah, good.
You know what I'm saying? Like, so if right, so like one of the students works. Well, I guess I shouldn't say specifically what students do. Okay, just imagine a person who has does mentoring with individuals in a given kind of career field or whatever, and they decide, I want to take this, figure out how to bring it into the LA prison system so that I work with individuals so when they get out, they're able to be employed in this field. And I want to develop partnerships with leaders in this field in the city to hire them. And my goal is to be a liaison that equips prisoners to come out employable in this place I'm passionate about. And I'm going to find the community leaders, the faith leaders, and the business leaders to make this a successful and sustainable project.
And so for 3 years, you're going to work on that.
They're going to do that, and you know, that's – but now what does that look like? Does it mean that they end up starting a business themselves? Does it mean that they partner with a specific, you know, business? Like, it could be – what it looks like is very – it's kind of like you just need to know, like, do you have the passion and the desire and the ability to do something that – you don't think is happening.
Right.
And could. And if it just had the support it needed, beauty would burst out that people would love and celebrate, but you just didn't know it could be there because you didn't know if the support was going to exist. So, like, if you have that kind of goal and passion and dream, and you come and you participate, it's our job to make sure that we connect the dots and build the support around you and empower and equip you to do it. For me, that's, like, super challenging. Like, that means, like, when you're talking about, like, reading Bonhoeffer or whatever and thinking about the nature of discipleship, it is specifically being engaged for the very purpose of then what does it look like for these seven or eight different people in this room talking in their in the places they're called to serve and develop community. Like, not let me just give you the uncontextualized version and then you repeat it back to me in ways that I appreciate.
Well, that will definitely be a challenge, but I'm confident, as I'm sure everybody who knows you is, in your ability to navigate that. I'll be really interested to hear how you do that and what you learn. Let me hear your idea thing, and then I feel like I need to let you go.
All right. So here's the thing. I had an idea I was talking with a couple of my friends, and they are parts of different kind of like house churches and small groups and things who left their kind of worshiping communities for, you know, Jesus-y reasons.
Got it.
And I thought of it because you mentioned that notion of Presbyterians wanting to start worshiping communities. And so I thought of, like, what would it be like to have a regular pop-up worship service? Not like in a weird place or anything, but where you say, like, this group of people, we're going to do worship services once a month, and that's it. Not because worship is the point of the church, but because part of being a member of the church is like having these communal experiences of confession, worship, reflection on the word, and this kinds of stuff. But we don't want to create a whole complex around it that then has to justify and employ people in a particular way. What would it be like just to have worship services, and that's it?
Yeah.
And then assume that as you become more attached to the faith, you're going to develop community. You're going to find your places to serve the people that you engage with intimately and stuff. But there'll be, you know, a collection of people go, like, we want to worship together, so we'll have worship services. And that's it.
And maybe even, like, anything as definite as once a month. Just this is happening, you know, at this day, at this time. Give, like, a week's notice, and then that's it. Then it disappears until the next time it comes around, and you do it the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and think of it more as like worship as an art show, where the people that put it together put a lot of energy into doing something that's beautiful, reflective, engaging, and like we even talked about, like you do it, and it's just like it's more like a ticketed event, where it's not even like you're sitting around asking for money. You go, we wanted to do this, we made this. We want to share it with you. We want you to participate, and we aren't going to sit around and ask you for money. Like, a lot of us volunteered a lot of time to go into it. We need to sell so many tickets to break even on it, so here's just, you know, get your ticket, and here's the event or something like that, where it's like you're even disengaging from the normal, like, this person donates this, and this person gives this or whatever. But you also want to be able to, like, if you're bringing in musicians or artists or whatever, like, recognize that those gifts are something that should be supported and validated.
They have value.
Yeah.
Right. When you were talking about those different pop-up projects, I was thinking about, you know, a pop-up church, and that's probably a little too much in one idea, but you're separating it out into a pop-up worship service. I wonder if you couldn't also use that same mentality around other, you know, components of the church's life, like a pop-up event around faith formation, a pop-up event around serving the poor, a pop-up event around, you know, other pieces of the church that does all of those things, splitting them out into individual projects that happen sporadically and gather a community around those particular things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a cool idea. The whole pop-up thing, when you started talking about it, got me thinking. Because I do think our assumptions about longevity of community are outdated, and the notion that, you know, you have to justify your existence for as long as you possibly can doesn't help anyone. And there needs to be a point where you say, we set out to do this thing, and we did it, and now we're done.
Yeah.
So, anyway. And on that note, I set out to talk to you, and you were gracious to do that, and now we're done. I feel like we could talk for a lot longer. I'm going to have a hard time editing this down to like an hour. I don't even know if I'm going to try. But let's definitely talk again. I mean, as it'll be September before you start at the hatchery, and once that starts, you're probably going to be crazy busy. But I definitely want to connect with you again, and I feel like there's some – I had like five or six questions that I never even got to, so –
Don't worry. We'll talk again, and if I have to wait until the end of November, because then I'll be trying to sell my new book I'm working on. So don't worry.
That's what we're gonna. We're gonna do you on the podcast again, and the book will be what we talk about.
Yes, I don't worry. I have no problem asking anyone I know with a podcast to talk to me about the book, because.
You've earned about 500 podcast appearances with all the people you've interviewed about their books. Nobody should know you know.
Yeah, I'm like, look, it's not long. It's not going to be horrible. And Fortress is pricing it cheap. So if you just pretend you like it and buy a copy and never look at it, that's fine. But it really will make my heart feel better.
Awesome. Now, what's the title and when is it going
to
be out?
Oh, it's The Homebrewed Christianity Guide to Jesus. The subtitle is... Lord, Lunatic, Liar, or Just Freaking Awesome.
When's it coming out?
As long as Sweet Jesus makes sure my fingers keep moving, to come out at the American Academy of Religion in November.
All right, and Fortress is publishing it.
Yeah, it's a first of 10 volumes in this Homebrewed Christianity Guide 2 series.
Seriously, you've got a 10-volume series going?
Yeah, but I'm not. I'm the series editor. I'm writing the first one, not all 10.
But it's your series. It's the name comes from your podcast.
Yes.
That's awesome. That's really great, Trip.
And you want to know, I don't know if I've told people, but so at the release thing at AAR, you know who I'm interviewing on the podcast in Atlanta during my little book release soiree?
Jesus.
Not Jesus. He hasn't made his eschatological arrival, but Jürgen Moltmann.
Shut up.
No joke.
Man, that's got to be the best get you've ever had.
I mean, like, he's flying to the United States, and then he said it'll probably be his last trip here.
Oh my gosh! And you get to interview him on that trip.
Yeah, and the live podcast from AAR will, I mean, you know, a month out or so, will post up, and people can sign up for free, and then live stream the whole thing.
Oh man, no pressure with that interview.
Well, I mean, my thought is, as long as the questions aren't bad, whatever he says, it'll be cool.
Well, thanks for your time today. Thanks for all you're doing. I look forward to the book, and I want to see everything else that you're working on and have you on the podcast again soon, okay?
All righty. Peace.
All right. Peace. Thanks, Trip.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks again to Trip Fuller for his time this week. Good luck, Trip, with the conference in a couple of weeks and with the Hatchery. We'll have you back on soon to hear how that's going. Thanks also to Landon Witsit, a.k.a. Go to Sleep John Darling, for composing and recording the theme music to the podcast. And as always, thanks to Brian Ellison for that terrific introduction to the podcast. You can hear Brian if you live in Kansas City on KCUR Public Radio, or you could Google KCUR and look up their archives, and Brian's shows are on there. You should listen to them because they're great and he's really good. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next time. Have a great week. Bye.